Final case of the morning is Bender against Freed. Mr. Douglas.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Bruce J. Douglas, the law firm of Larkin, Hoffman, Daly, and Lindgren from Minneapolis. I represent the appellant and defendant, third-party plaintiff, the Berquist Company Employee Health Plan. It's my honor to be here this morning, my first appearance before the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals. We have put before the court, Your Honor, in this appeal, two issues. We've briefed them. I won't repeat the brief. I have only 2 points to make to the court. The first issue is as to the timeliness for the health plan's motion for attorney's fees. The defendant, Mr. Todrick, contends that the motion was untimely under Rule 54. We contend that it was not, for the reasons stated, that this court has previously held that motions for attorney's fees are not governed by the time limit of Rule 54 by virtue of the fact, the holding in Bittner versus Sadoff and Rudoy, that ERISA provides as substantive relief the award of attorney's fees and not attorney's fees as a matter of the costs, and therefore it is within the exception.
I don't understand why that matters. There are separate subsections of Rule 54D2. One deals with costs and one deals with fees. So to say that fees are different from costs is perfectly true, but it doesn't explain why they're not covered by the subsection directly dealing with fees.
Your Honor, the reason for that is that this court has previously held that it is substantive relief and not a matter of post-judgment costs. This issue was covered directly.
You're not addressing my question. It's perfectly clear they are not costs. They are fees.
Yes.
Rule 54D2B deals with fees. Rule 54D2A deals with costs. So why aren't attorney's fees covered by a provision dealing with attorney's fees?
Well, in this case, they are not. The provision of 54D2A excludes them, Your Honor, because...
Exactly. They're not costs. They're fees. That's why they're within D2B.
Well, actually, Your Honor, the language of D2A deals with attorney's fees, where it states that attorney's fees and related non-taxable expenses shall be made by motion unless the substantive law governing the action provides for the recovery of such fees as an element of damages to be proved at trial. And that is the holding in the previous case of Bittner.
I thought the holding of Bittner was that fees should be a motion. Fees should be litigated by way of a Rule 54 motion.
Well,
we conclude that an attorney's fee award under Section 1132G1 should be sought, as it was here, by the filing of a motion under Rule 54.
Yes, Your Honor. That's what the court said in Bittner. However, the context of the Bittner case was that it arose as a post-trial Rule 59E motion. At the time of the Bittner case, there was no time limit in Rule 54. It was motions for attorney's fees and costs were to be made within a reasonable time. The 10-day time period came into Rule 54 after the decision in Bittner. The issue under 59, the court held in Bittner under 59E on a different point, certainly saying you should bring it by motion. But on the substantive issue, the court's holding is very clear that ERISA is one of the types of statutes where the attorney's fees are not a matter of, quote, taxable costs that are done necessarily post-judgment and covered by 54D2B. That's essentially what we have to look at in this case. Therefore, it is the plan's contention that the 14-day time limit, now, pardon me, the 14-day time limit of Rule 54 is inapplicable to this motion for attorney's fees in an ERISA case. The second aspect of our argument on the Rule 54 claim, of course, Your Honor, is that in any event, it was made in a timely manner. We suggested to the court, in fact, requested that we be allowed 30 days after entry of judgment to make the motion. The court did not say yay or nay on that. The court then issued its judgment after granting summary judgment, and we did file the motion within 30 days, like 30 plus 3
for
mailing.
Yeah, but the court not saying yay or nay doesn't mean it would be granted.
Oh, I understand, Your Honor. I'm not saying that the court sanctioned the procedure. In fact, by its decision, clearly, Judge Shabazz is saying that I didn't give you the 30 days. But in terms of the policy underlying it, and I recognize that the Seventh Circuit has not followed the rule of the Fifth Circuit, that the case we cited. But all parties certainly were on notice that attorney's fees were going to be requested in this case. As a matter of fact, attorney's fees were sought and included in the motion for attorney's fees itself, and then the argument and the presentation of that was reserved for post-judgment. As the Fifth Circuit noted, that the object of the short time limit of Rule 54 is to put the parties on notice that fees will be requested, and certainly in this case, after the parties had all the discussion they had about the subject of attorney's fees during the final pretrial conference, there was no doubt the motion would be forthcoming. We submit on that issue, Your Honor, that the Circuit Court of Appeals already has decided that because the attorney's fees are not part of the costs in an ERISA matter, that the time limit of Rule 54 is inapplicable. On the second point, Your Honor, on Section 1927, we ask this court to take a very close look and to take a careful look at the conduct of Attorney Todrick. The district court held that it could not apply, could not consider the plan's motion for sanctions under Section 1927 because the conduct of which we complained essentially was the pre-litigation handling of the matter by Attorney Todrick. We believe, Your Honor, that Your Honors, that Section 1927 allows this court.
Now, the principal way in which pre-litigation conduct is dealt with is by application to the state disciplinary apparatus. Have you brought Todrick's behavior to the attention of state disciplinary apparatus?
Yes, we have.
So what more could or would we do?
Section 1927, Your Honor, is one mechanism. Certainly there's also Rule 11. There's the inherent powers of the court. But certainly Section 1927 is another mechanism by which the federal courts can police the conduct that occurs within its courthouses. The conduct of Attorney Todrick, we submit, Your Honor, is particularly egregious.
But it occurred out of court. It occurred before the litigation got going. And therefore, one would think, within the jurisdiction of the state's disciplinary officials.
Section 1927, however, Your Honor, does not draw the line between pre-litigation conduct and post-litigation conduct. And as a matter of fact,
certainly it does. It talks about multiplying the proceedings. It doesn't talk about conduct that leads people to file lawsuits.
The proceedings were multiplied, in fact, Your Honor. They were invented by Attorney Todrick as a result of this matter.
The other way of putting this is, I'm inclined to think that your position is legally frivolous and therefore sanctionable. I mean, this interpretation of Section 1927 is spacey, and you were told so in no uncertain terms by the district court. And the fact that the other side's lawyer has gone off the deep end doesn't mean that you can make any silly argument about any inapplicable proceeding, about any inapplicable statute, and hope we'll do something for you. One unethical legal step doesn't justify frivolous litigation in its wake. And that's what we're seeing here.
I do appreciate the court's sentiment on that point, Your Honor. We do not consider our argument under 1927 to be frivolous, and we have presented authority to the court that we believe supports it. What has happened in this case, Your Honor, and if it is allowed to continue, it is a license for any attorney to defraud an ERISA benefit plan. And that is what has happened here. May I reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal, Your Honor? Thank you.
Mr. Fishbach.
Good morning, Your Honor. My name is Nathan Fishbach. I represent Philip Todrick and the Todrick Law Firm. The issue in this case is whether the district court erred in not awarding attorney's fees. I would suggest that under Rule 54D, 14 days after judgment is the applicable standard. In this case, the request for attorney's fees was filed on September 27th, beyond that time limit. The date is clear. In fact, there was an order of the court on August 18th, which was alluded to by the appellant in his brief. In that order that came after a status conference, there was no mention at all of any time, of an extension of time for filing the attorney's fees request. And so the 14-day rule would apply. Second, under Bittner, I would suggest to the court that that case of the Seventh Circuit specifically said that under this particular ERISA Act, the proper place to file a request for attorney's fees is under Rule 54D. Third, there has been a mention in the appellant's brief that somehow the appellee was on notice in the lower court that there would be a request for an attorney's fee. And they cite the Fifth Circuit case, Romero-Guerrero. In that case, a 1998 case, it was very clear that the Court of Appeals affirmed the district court holding that the district court said that the request for attorney's fees beyond 14 days was warranted. In that case, the Fifth Circuit said, in normal circumstances, a request for attorney's fees has to be under 54. The next issue before this court is whether 1927 applies. We would submit that under 1927, that regards litigation conduct. In this case, there is no indication at all that Mr. Todrick or the Todrick law firm delayed the proceedings, took any steps to prolong the proceedings. In fact, the litigation that was conducted by Mr. Todrick in bringing the plan into play in this matter was because it was necessary under state law to bring a necessary party. For those reasons, we believe the decision of the district court should be affirmed.
Mr. Fishbeck, yes. I have to ask a particularized question. There was a response by Mr. Douglas to a question from the bench about a disciplinary complaint being filed with the Office of Lawyer Regulation in Wisconsin. Are you aware of the status of that and whether it has been adjudicated? It's not ringing any bells with me, but...
Your Honor, The Keith Saleen of the Office of Lawyer Regulation issued a ruling stating that the Office of Lawyer Regulation was not going to pursue this matter.
Okay. And there wasn't any appeal of that up through the channels?
I think originally an investigator issued that ruling, and then that was appealed through Mr. Saleen. And I think Mr. Saleen is the final arbiter of whether the disciplinary proceedings can be commenced.
So nothing was before the Wisconsin Supreme Court in the last 6 years?
That's as far as I know, yes.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mm-hmm.
I'm trying to get out.
Anything further, Mr. Douglas?
Yes, sir.
Two quick points. On the Rule 54D issue, the point being, the parties certainly were aware at the status conference on August 13th or 18th that a motion for attorney's fees would be filed. In fact, they were so aware of it, they'd argued to the court at the status conference even before we could bring the motion for attorney's fees, because we had just learned that day of the granting of summary judgment that it was already untimely. The court advised the parties that, of course, it was not untimely. He would consider the matter post-judgment. My request for 30 days after for post-judgment filing was before the court. It was not specifically ruled on. We read the order as permitting a reasonable time, but in any event, we believe that Rule 54 excludes from the time limit motions for attorney's fees under ERISA. As to the second point, I'd like to address the issue the appellee put before the court, and I believe the papers are in the file, the series of correspondence and the ruling of the Wisconsin Lawyers Board on the issue. What it essentially amounts to is a matter of prosecutorial discretion not to pursue the matter. Apparently, the Wisconsin Board has a policy of interpreting its rule to require the lawyer have engaged in a signed written agreement to protect the interests of an ERISA plan before it will find that it has violated the particular rule that we alleged. The rule was modified, however, after the conduct involved in this case. Under the new rule, Director Saleen believes that the rule would apply to the conduct involved here. That being the case, his decision not to pursue the matter is, of course, final under the Wisconsin procedure. Now, having said that, what we ask is that the court look at this conduct and ask itself if this is the type of conduct it expects from attorneys practicing in the circuit, in the district courts in this circuit. For an attorney to use the Supreme Court's holding in Great West as a driver's license and a roadmap to defraud ERISA plans can have grave consequences. Thank you, Your Honors.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much. The case is taken under advisement.